Welcome to the Manhattan Institute's Innovative Ideas Podcast. Today we're going to be speaking to Thomas J. Phillipson, PhD, the Daniel Levin Professor of Public Policy at the University of Chicago and the Chairman of the Manhattan Institute's Project FDA. Also from 2003 to 2004, he served as a Senior Economic Advisor to the Commissioner of the FDA, and in 2008 as a Senior Healthcare Advisor to the presidential campaign of Senator John McCain. Tom, thank you for joining us on the Innovative Ideas Podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
You've got a piece in Forbes that talks about the science of comparative effectiveness research, and you begin by talking about a very famous quip that President Obama made, I believe, at a press conference last summer, where he said, quote, "If there's a blue pill and a red pill, and the blue pill is half the price of the red pill and works just as well, why not pay half price for the thing that's going to make you well?" One of the key ideas behind healthcare reform is lowering costs and improving the quality of things that we pay for. So what are the potential problems with finding the blue pill that works just as well as the red pill and paying for that?
Well, the gist of it is that the blue pill essentially works for some people and the red pill works for others. So many times in medicine, some treatments are successful on one set of patients and other treatments are successful on another set of patients. So the comparative effectiveness movement, which I discussed in the article, is essentially aimed at finding things that work. Implicit assumption there is sort of a specific to a given treatment, that one treatment is best for all patients. And that's the clash, I think, with the practice of medicine, where many times we have first-line therapy failing, but second-line therapy working. So that's what I get into in the article, talking about the problems with that kind of approach, which is implicit in the CER evaluation framework currently, and how it clashes with how medicine is practiced.
And in particular, you talk about a class of drugs known as antipsychotics. And how about, you know, this class of drug was created in the 1950s to control schizophrenia, but it has a very severe side effect, not life-threatening, but disabling nonetheless, called tardive dyskinesia, which results in increasingly frenetic physical and facial movements that can be disfiguring to the person who's taking the drug. It helps control the disease, but it has this severe side effect. In the 1990s, a new class of drugs came along, atypical antipsychotics, that because they were still under patent protection, were obviously more expensive than the older drugs, which had long since become generics, but appeared to offer a better side effect profile than the older drugs. And can you talk for a minute just about what you found in your study of the effects of these two different classes of drugs?
Yeah, our study is sort of aimed at looking at what if we take this agenda seriously and for the antipsychotics and trace out what happens. So what we took as a representative comparative effectiveness study was the CATY trial that was conducted in 1999. Which the main finding coming out of the CATY trials was essentially that first-generation drugs were equally effective to second-generation drugs. Now, even though not recognized in the policy arena, that's a very puzzling finding, given that second-generation drugs captured 90% of the market at higher prices. So that would be very suspicious if they were equally effective, that they can actually capture the whole market at higher prices. But taking that as aside, if you take that study and therefore say, which many people did, well, Medicaid should not pay for second-generation drugs. They're equally effective to first-generation drugs, and they cost more. Why should we have the Medicaid program paying for these drugs? So what we did in that study was essentially say, suppose a prototypical CER study, comparative effectiveness research study, came out like the CATY trial, and you therefore base reimbursement policy on it, saying that we're only going to reimburse, in this case, the first-line treatments, and we're not going to reimburse the second-line treatment. What we found then that is, yes, you're going to save a lot of money, about 90% of class spending within this group in Medicaid, but what happened is that you had a lot of damage, that you would have a lot of damage to health, assuming that this poor population cannot afford the drugs, the second generation drugs that were not reimbursed. In fact, that damage to health came in at around 98% in the study. So you had a net loss essentially imposed by reimbursing for what would be the most cost effective drug in the CATY trial. They were equally effective, but the first generation was costing less. And the reason this occurs is because when a CER basically comes out with a winner, which the CATY trial would do or did, The problem is that for some patients, the winner in that study is a loser. That is to say, some people respond well to first-line therapy or first-generation drugs, and some patients respond better to second-line therapy or second-generation drugs. In particular, this is important. The result we got was essentially due to that a lot of people that did not respond to first-line generation drugs did respond in the CATIE trial. This is evidence from the CATIE trial, did respond much better on the second-line treatment. So again, the main issue is that as we think of comparative effectiveness studies now, it's too simplistic a view of how medical care is practiced. That is, there's a winner or loser that is best for all patients, as opposed to when you have heterogeneous responses across patients, that some patients favor this blue pill we talked about earlier, and some patients favor the red pill. In this case, you rename blue and red with the first and second line generation drugs.
I think in some disease areas, let's say AIDS, there's an acknowledgement that, of course, there's a resistance on the part of the AIDS virus, and so you need a continual armamentarium of new drugs coming to market to treat drug-resistant AIDS viruses, or for antibiotics, for that matter. You have the continual evolution of bacteria that are drug-resistant. You also have people who just have allergies to different drugs, different reactions. Why is it that I think that, you know, there's a kind of a common sense, I think, view that, yes, that's right, drugs work very differently for different people, not only for you know, the bacterial world or the viral world, but just in general, people have different reactions to drugs. Why has that not made it from kind of the common sense world into the public policy debate?
Well, I think one of the issues is that once you push more and more of spending onto the healthcare to the public sector, today we have about 50% of medical care being financed by the public sector. And given what happened in Massachusetts, I don't want to speculate what the future share will be, but it is true that once you have a large share of spending financed through public financing, you get enormous budget pressures on the government to keep these spending levels down. Once that comes into place, you need some rational scheme for choosing of what you should or should not spend on. And that's when these sort of one-size-fits-all policies take place, because it looks rational in terms of a spending strategy. But if you dig deeper, it sort of goes against the decentralized nature of medicine, which would be more effective than these centralized policies, I think.
Is there another mechanism that, I mean, besides obviously, you know, try and fail and try and fail, you know, just kind of ad hoc experimentation with drugs that can help, you know, eventually you figure out what works for the patient. Is there any kind of insurance mechanism that would help improve decision-making from physicians in finding the first, you know, treatment to begin with, that would kind of short-circuit this decision, this, you know, cheap versus expensive question, and really get to the underlying point I think you're making, that you want the most effective treatment?
Well, I mean, the question is how these studies, the CR or other studies, are what evidence they produce. Like currently they produce essentially what works best for patients. For example, the fraction of people who respond to a given therapy in a randomized clinical trial, that would be, you know, maybe 50% respond to the red pill and 40% respond to the blue pill. And there we go, and we're going to now only reimburse the red pill. The problem with those, that kind of evidence being generated, is again that it doesn't capture how medicine is practiced with sequencing treatment. So I have argued that a better, a more useful evidence would be if trials reported much more on what happens conditional on failure. That is to say, if one therapy fails, what's the likelihood of a second line therapy working? You could have two extreme scenarios where everyone who fails on the first line will fail on the second line, and then we shouldn't go on with the second line. We could save a lot of money by stopping after the first line. On the other hand, you could have that a lot of people who don't respond in the first line respond in the second line. That was the CATIE trial in antipsychotics. That's the evidence there. In that case, it's very useful to have reimbursement for the second line therapy or subsequent therapies more generally. So I think my take on this is that the thinking is a little bit naive right now and too rudimentary. It needs to generate better evidence on conditional responses of therapies when we have failed the initial treatment assigned.
And probably also not just for drugs, but drugs versus procedures or other forms of healthcare that are potentially substitutes for each other, or that could be thought of as substitutes for each other.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of this has come down to procedural evaluation, the CR that is discussed in the context of regional variation, the fact that Miami is so much more expensive than Minnesota, for example. Some of that is just fraud, or the inability of the public sector to monitor claims as much as the private sector. But some of that is also essentially using CR for evaluating procedures as opposed to treatment. And I think that's a very important role where I think it's more useful, actually, because CR applied to drugs and medical devices and biologics is on top of the incentives that private companies have to get the right information out. Presumably, if you have intellectual property on these technologies, you have a very strong incentive to not be misportrayed in terms of having too low efficacy.
And there's a built-in, there's a built-in incentive for pharmaceutical companies. I would expect with patents, in other words, because you know you're facing a patent cliff and you're facing a generic drug, you want to show payers that your drug is going to be effective versus that other drug. So I know companies have run. I think Plavix is about to lose protection. They've run studies against Plavix. Zocor, when it was under patent, ran a trial against Lipitor. That there is this built-in competitive incentive for pharmaceutical companies, at least, to try and to show effectiveness versus other treatments.
Yeah, any manufacturer, any producer in any market want to demonstrate the benefits of their products, and pharmaceutical is not unique in that. On top, what's unique here is that the state, the government, mandates them to show it through the FDA approval process. So there is efficacy studies mandated, and the question is how much does the evidence improve going beyond placebo-controlled trials to comparative trials? It's not necessarily the case that that's a lot of information contained. If we would know the red pill works against placebo 70% of the times and the blue pill 50% of the times, then we know a lot about how the blue versus red pill works.
Right.
So the question is, we have mandated studies for product quality in this area, and it's not necessarily the case that it would be useful to put our layer on top of that by publicly financing comparisons of quality in this area. And that's different than a procedure. Procedures, you don't own them. Procedures are not owned by anyone. There's no intellectual property, so there's no incentive for people to get the right information out on procedures. And that's why I think focusing on procedures is more productive in using public spending than it is going after a private sector, which has the right incentives and also is mandated in providing that type of evidence.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Tom Phillipson's paper, The Blue Pill or the Red Pill, is available at Forbes.com. And the paper on which it's based, by Tom Phillipson, his co-author, Anabiran Basu, I apologize if I mispronounce his name, is available NBER, and it's entitled The Impact of Comparative Effectiveness Research on Health and Healthcare Spending, NBER Working Paper number 15633. Tom, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.